Welcome to Legal News and Review, produced with the Broward County Bar Association and their attorney referral service. Recorded live at Alpine Jaguar in Fort Lauderdale. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorneys, Charles Moorhead, president-elect of Broward County Bar Association, and Gary Singer, chair of Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Charles Moorhead is a board-certified civil trial lawyer and rated as one of the best lawyers in America. And Gary Singer is board-certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. Both attorneys are experts in their fields of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's program, in the appellate arena, everything is based on the law. And on record, you cannot turn on the news without hearing about the U.S. Supreme Court and the appeals that go before them from Obamacare, abortion, and even gun control. Today, we're very pleased to feature Robin Bresky from the law offices of Robin Bresky, who focuses exclusively on appellate law and recently featured December 28, 2015 in Forbes magazine. Also, this week's Legal News in Review, and that's presented by Charles Moorhead and Gary Singer. And we have a special guest calling in from Illinois who was actually the go-to guy for the appeals for the Attorney General's office. His name is Ronald Bell, and that means he's my brother, but that's not why he's on the program. I was actually with him when he did the appeal with John Wayne Gacy, which was an interesting thing that we're going to touch on as well. First of all, I'd like to say Happy New Year and good evening to Charles Moorhead.
Hey, Philip, how are you?
Great. And, of course, Happy New Year and good evening to Gary Singer.
Welcome back, Phil. Time for a great new year.
Oh, yes. Well, we're starting off the new year great because we are receiving a special recognition from the Chambers of Commerce, and that is an award that we're winning for our public service and commitment and outreach. And we all get special plaques, and next time we're producing, I will make sure you guys have them. It's pretty exciting.
Wow, that's very exciting. Yeah. Congratulations to us.
You know, they tuned in, and we're making a difference, guys. We really are.
I'm glad to hear it.
We absolutely are. And first of all, also, I'd like to say good evening to Ronald Bell, who's actually calling in from Illinois.
Hello, Philip.
Hi, Ron. Good to hear your voice, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you. You too.
Now, Mr. Bell, we do have a tradition. Every time you call in, you get to tell us a story about Phil's childhood.
He's got all the dirt.
Right?
Yes, he does.
I think maybe we should save that for its entire show by itself, Phil.
He's my older brother.
I heard Philip got engaged over the holidays. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I can tell you the story about the 67 storm that had 10-foot snow.
Oh, here we go.
And
true
Philip
story.
Got climbed up on one and fell behind. I heard some whimpering. And how long has he been out there? I have no idea. So I have to get a shovel and I have to dig him out. And he was crying and he was all red and he was very shaky.
Well, tell the truth. You actually flipped a coin whether you were going to walk away or get me out.
It sounds like the plot of Frozen 2. Disney doesn't steal. Now, what does I hear about you getting engaged?
Yes, I got engaged. Now my brother knows, thanks. I got engaged New Year's Eve. Actually,
congratulations!
I was stone sober. Wow. Thank you. I was stone sober at the time, but not later.
If you were sober, that means it's probably true love.
You know, Robin, you focus your practice on and exclusively in the appeal arena, and you're so well known. I mean, even the article within Forbes as well, and that's what I love about the law. It's not over till it's over. Until it goes to the highest court in the land, of course.
That's true.
And you have a host of cases we're going to be talking about and things that I actually was like, gee, wow, that, you know, it was a solid decision. But that's just it. It's the law, but everything is recorded. It's not like you go before a jury. Tell me the process, first of all, so our listeners can understand, you know, what an appeal actually is. And I believe there's a statute of limitations on all appeals.
Well, it's actually, and I'll speak primarily about Florida, but of course every state has a little bit different picayune rules. Some of them overlap and are similar. But essentially, the appellate process has to do with taking an order from a lower tribunal or a trial court and appealing it to the next higher court, whether it be a mid-level court, whether it be the state Supreme Court, whether it be a federal appellate court, or the United States Supreme Court. It depends on where you're going, but the process is similar in that a notice of appeal needs to be filed in the lower tribunal, mm-hmm. and then a initial brief needs to be done where you basically in writing outline the arguments as to why the lower court's ruling is erroneous. Then the other side responds with an answer brief, and then the appellant who wrote the initial brief responds with a reply brief to that. Could be various motions in between and different things, but that's essentially the process. And oftentimes there'll be an oral argument where you go in front of a panel of judges and argue why the lower tribunal got this wrong or got this right, why it should be reversed or why it should be affirmed. And that's in a nutshell the process.
Well, going right into one of your cases that was headlined as well is that your firm won a reversal of an order basing a father's child support obligation on what's considered, I guess, abnormally high income. Now, to me, that seemed originally was adjudicated, but you were hired regarding this appeal.
So in this particular case, it was a situation where the lower court basically used the father's bonus to calculate what the ongoing child support should be. And it was he was a political consultant, actually, and it was an election year. And he had made a lot of income in that particular year. And I'm sorry, I misspoke. It wasn't his bonus, but it was a large amount of money that he made in a particular year that we argued was akin to a bonus. Bonuses are not typically figured into a calculation of child support moving forward. And so the appellate court, after we actually did a rehearing on this, so it went through several levels, and winning rehearings at the appellate level is often an uphill battle, but this is a case where we did. And so the court basically said, no, this calculation of child support, that one off year where you made all this extra money, should not inure to every other year.
But that motion must have been very compelling for a rehearing, urging the court to consider matters that the court might have overlooked.
Right, and that's exactly what a rehearing is. When you think we have a written opinion and you think that the appellate court has overlooked something, you do a motion for rehearing. And we've been fortunate to win several of those, and they are uphill battles. But, of course, the client was very happy with that.
Well, you know, you can't make everyone happy on any decision. And, you know, they always, you know, if you lose, let's face it, you want to appeal it. But that doesn't mean you're granted an appeal. And if you appeal it, you have to pay fees for that?
So if you go for an appeal, there are fees where the clerk of court charges fees, you know, that's how the clerk makes their money, to charge fees. It's a new proceeding, just like if you file a complaint in a lower tribunal in a trial court, you have to pay the fee for the petition or the complaint. And so, yes, there are fees involved. And our job as appellate attorneys is first and foremost, the threshold is to make sure there's a good faith basis for the appeal, that it's not a frivolous appeal. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we advise our client, if we decide to take the appeal, what we think the chances are of prevailing on that. And so that the courts have to hear, especially here in Florida, plenary or final appeals. There are certain appeals they have to hear, and then there are certain discretionary appeals. And then, for example, the Florida Supreme Court, everything is discretionary. In the U.S. Supreme Court, everything is discretionary. But certain mid-level courts have to hear final appeals and appeals from final judgments, and certain courts have the discretion to decide whether or not they want to take these cases. And, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court takes a minuscule amount of cases that come before it.
But they're always headline grabbing.
Let me chime in there, Philip.
Go ahead, Ron.
This is Ron Bell. Robin, what listeners who don't know about litigation don't understand is that while you may have a right to an appeal after every case at the trial level, not every case is appealable to be meritorious. In other words, just because you don't like the decision doesn't mean the case should be appealed. It's more like there must be a misinterpretation of a law, or a law applied to the facts was applied wrong.
Absolutely.
And I think you would agree with this, being an appellate attorney, that we have a sign that a judge has locally here, that in his courtroom, he has a big sign that says, the worst settlement is better
been the best lawsuit. And I asked him why. You know, he says, because with a lawsuit, all you get is an appeal.
Right.
With a settlement, you get finality.
Well, you know, Ron, Robin does criminal, and I was with you. You brought me down to Springfield, Illinois, when you did the appeal.
Yeah, that case was the People v. Smith, right, a search and seizure of automobiles on that case. And that was before the Supreme Court of Illinois.
What about?
And it was an interesting case. It was a case, Robin, that the we had a reasonable man standard in Illinois for a search and seizure of automobiles, meaning would a reasonable man believe there was contraband in the car after what they observed? And I argued to the appellate, to the Supreme Court, that it should be a police officer with his skill and knowledge, no, as opposed to the reasonable man, and to walk away from the reasonable man standard. In that particular case, as People v. Smith, there was a one-hitter box, and in that part of Illinois, they knew a one-hitter box would contain drugs, and the police would know that a syringe would be nearby. A reasonable man would know that. The argument was to the Supreme Court, why do we train these officers and give them all this training and their experience and then throw it to a reasonable man standard and say, would a cab driver know? Would this for a bus driver know? A reasonable man. It should be allowed to be used the experience. And we walked away with that. And we argued the Ross case, United States Supreme Court case of Ross. And Illinois adopted my standard, which was a police officer with his skill and knowledge can search automobiles if he believes there is contraband.
Congratulations.
I'm a reasonable guy. What's a one-hitter box?
And Philip was amazed because, and I was amazed because I didn't know that behind the Supreme Court in Illinois,
yeah,
there's another room, a door you open up, it's all sealed and you don't know it, but it's a panel door, and all of a sudden the Chief Justice walks behind the door and he leaves. I thought I was losing the argument, that he was disgusted with me or something, but that didn't happen. What happened was he's a smoker and he had some coffee. It was early in the morning. And he went back there and they have a video and they have sound. This was told to me after the argument.
And
it turned out
that
he was the judge that actually wrote the opinion.
Huh.
He adopted everything I said.
I remember that. And that's
remember that? We were
yes.
looking at each other. What the hell's going on? They're walking away from me.
That was the Illinois Supreme Court as well. But
that's a one-hitter box. I really want to know. What is it?
That was the case.
Do you know, Charles?
Oh, Charles is going to hit you.
No. Is that like some sort of drug?
I assume
it's some dope addict thing
which,
you and I should
Robin
know.
Would,
that's right.
I don't know.
Those that don't do don't know.
When I was an attorney general, I had my chief drop the Gacy appeal on John Wayne Gacy appeal on my desk. He said, read it and tell me what you think, what we should do with this. So I read it and I met with the attorney general on it. It was a very it was the best appellate brief. I still have it somewhere that was ever written that I've ever seen. It had every search and seizure case ever cited practically in the United States, and certainly the Supreme Court, in it. It was, it's not like a normal appellate brief because it was a death penalty brief. It was extremely large, hundreds of pages, and I had to read through the whole thing. And what the sum and substance was is that they did not have a warrant when they went in to John Wayne Gacy's house.
Yeah.
And Illinois Attorney General is the only one licensed to go before the Supreme Court of Illinois on any case. So all the state's attorneys, lower prosecutors, have to refer the case to us. And it was Mayor Daley's case. So we had a sit down. We were discussing it. And even though they found, I don't know, 17, 18 bodies in his basement, he obviously did a thing. The question was the smell enough to give probable cause to search that basement? Or should they have had time to get a warrant to do something about it? Very interesting discussion. The end result was a political one. We talked about it at length, and we decided that we were going to defer to the people that were more familiar with the facts, the local prosecutors, and we were going to allow them on this one exception to take the appeal to the Supreme Court instead of us handling it. Politically,
The Attorney General at the time was a Republican. The other state attorney was a Democrat. And it was Mayor Daley and Ty Fainter. And we figured, look, if we win, we're supposed to win. They found 18 bodies in his basement. If we lose, remember, they found 18 bodies in his basement. That would be devastating. It was an election year,
yeah,
so we deferred the prosecution to the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and they handled the appeal. And the elected members of the Supreme Court, who are elected, not appointed, but they're elected, decided that that was a sufficient basis to search the house, the fact that there was a very foul odor.
You know, Ron, Robin wants to chime in.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say you're bringing back some memories for me when you mentioned the Cook County State Attorney's Office, because I went to law school in Chicago, Chicago Kent, and I actually externed for a couple of years in the appellate division at the Cook County State Attorney's Office.
Right.
And so I'm very pleased that the prosecutors there did a good job, because that's actually where I got involved and really knew I wanted to do appellate work. And working in Chicago was fantastic. And so
it worked out good that the Attorney General passed the buck for political reasons.
Yes, absolutely.
That's great. Yeah, it was only a mass murder.
Exactly.
Election's much more important. Let's pass the buck. I like it.
That's the point about
good thing
it.
We live in Florida.
You have to have a reason to appeal. And, of course, it's a matter of right, even to the Supreme Court of the United States, the Supreme Court of Illinois, at least, as a matter of right, when there's a death penalty involved. At that time, we had the death penalty. We don't have it anymore. Judge Ryan, who went to jail in Illinois, abolished it, and then he got indicted for problems when he was a Secretary of State with the driver's license issues. But he abolished the death penalty. We do not have one anymore in Illinois. But people listening on the radio, you just can't appeal a case because you don't like it.
No, but
you have to have reasons, and you need an appellate litigator like Robin to analyze the verbiage in the transcripts and the judge's order, compare it to case law to see if something was done wrong.
Well, let me chime in and ask a question on that matter and bring it back to Florida a little bit. You know, in my practice, I see when doing foreclosure work, people don't like the result. They often do appeal. So, you know, I know you're saying you have to find a mistake with the judge, but what happens when someone just appeals because they don't like the way the judge ruled, and now the other party, oftentimes the lender or maybe the homeowner, has all this expense? So what happens now?
That's correct. And the problem with that is, in order, when you walk into an appeal, the appellate court will not assert their opinion for the trier of fact. They will not overturn the judge's discretion if the judge could have ruled one way or ruled the other way. They will not get involved with that on a trial of fact. It has to be pretty much a matter of law, with the exception of a case that's against the manifest weight of the evidence. If it's against the manifest weight of the evidence that no other judge would rule this way, then in that rare case, and it's very rare, a lot of people allege it, but it's very rare that would occur.
What happens
is somebody just appeals, all they're doing is buying a delay. They're buying a delay to the owner or the mortgage company or whatever from coming in and taking the house and doing their thing, but not always a delay, because usually in most appeals on civil cases, in order to stop the enforcement of the judgment, you must post an appeal bond, which is money.
But I can jump in and tell you something, though. In my experience in the foreclosure appeals, the larger banks actually will not, and they can, you're right, they can go forward and enforce. But, you know, we've had, obviously, coming out of the foreclosure where Florida was very largely hit here.
Number one in the country.
Yeah, you know, I've been on both sides of this and the appeal. I've represented the lenders and I've represented the defendants, and the larger banks will not necessarily move forward for enforcement. And if you have a good faith basis, and I'm not saying this is the right way to go, but if you have a good faith basis as a defendant for some procedural error that the court made, I have seen it happen where, you know, it pushes settlement, especially here in Florida, where when the trial attorneys, you know, may not be able to really get any settlement or get anywhere, when it gets into the appellate court, we've settled some of these things because we've gone forward and the lender doesn't want to take the liability of if it does get reversed at the appellate court and they've kicked the homeowner out of the home. So, you know, it works in different ways. And sometimes appeals are used for leverage. As long as it's a good faith basis, they're used as a business tool sometimes as well. But again, there has to be a good faith basis.
You know, Robin, I know your work. You're a pro, and there's no doubt about it. But there are some attorneys out there, and pro se for that matter, that are filing a lot of these not such great appeals for the right reasons. And, I mean, probably, would you say even more than, you know, valid appeals? I mean, and it gums up the appellate system. And what's the recourse? What's the recourse to a party?
Yeah, a motion, a 57-105 motion here in Florida, where you basically say this is a frivolous appeal, and we've done that as appellee, to say this is a completely frivolous appeal and it shouldn't be here. And so you have to have a good faith basis to move forward on it.
Yeah, but
an
how
appeal.
Often does that actually work? I mean, seriously, I mean, 57-105 is great, and it's thrown around, especially at the trial level, in almost every case, it seems like. But, you know, how often, 1 in 1,000, do you see actually an award of money going on in that? Or is it more in the appellate arena?
It's not necessarily more. It has to be asserted in the right way. I mean, 57-105 should be used, should be used in the appropriate way. If it is being done just to stall things, if it's not being done in good faith, then it needs to be. And I've seen them granted. I mean, yes, they're not necessarily granted all the time. The problem is a lot of people use 57-105. A lot of attorneys use them as a sword rather than a shield. And it really should be not just thrown around because, I can see in most trial cases, 57-105, you know, they're brought up so much and say, you know, you have a frivolous case when in fact you don't. And that's the problem. It's like calling, you know, crying wolf.
And there's no repercussion for it. I mean, a lot of attorneys use 57-105, which is a frivolous appeal, which is saying this is completely frivolous. You need to pay my fees, and the attorney needs to pay half of
sanctions.
It.
Sanctions. It's basically sanctions.
Asking for sanctions. Right. But a lot of attorneys literally use it as a cover sheet for basically every motion.
That's right, and that's completely improper. And, in fact, I have an appeal where somebody was granted 57-105, and we appealed that, say that shouldn't have been a 57-105, and we took a big chance at the appellate level because the trial judge had said it was a frivolous case. We said it wasn't a frivolous case, and in fact, we got that reversed, saying that it wasn't a frivolous case. So
was that the one that involved $52,000?
I'm sorry?
Was that a $52,000 award or something I saw?
I don't know if that was a $52,000 award. That had to do with the issue with the.
But what does my point is, what does the aggrieved party get? They get put down there. Maybe they get an award of an appellate attorney's fees. But again, so now you have an underwater, let's say, use foreclosures or a divorce case. Now you have someone who has another judgment against them that they're never going to pay, but the other side had to lay out all this money. I mean, it just seems like it's so easy to file something frivolous and so hard to get compensated for it.
Well, it has to be pled the right way. If you plead in the appeal for your appellate fees, for example, in family law here in Florida, it's under Chapter 61, it's ability and need. So I have seen where people have appealed oftentimes in family law, and if they're not successful, they end up paying the other side for not only their fees but for the other side's fees. Well, so it cuts both ways.
I could tell you in Illinois, we do take a strong stance on that. When it used to be everybody asked for fees, it became a numbing effect to the appellate court, and they would just deny appeals, and that would be the end of it. But they have taken a more aggressive stance because of the backlog, and they are awarding fees.
But, Ron, Robin's firm is well known, and it's considered a boutique firm that focuses on appellate law. Mm-hmm. And one of her cases, I actually don't understand how you were able to get this done, was disqualifying a judge presiding over a family law case. You had a writ that disqualified this woman, I guess, because of her bias.
Yes, and basically, you know, we have done a writ of prohibition with regards to several, you know, judges. And the fact of the matter is, if a judge cannot be a neutral trier of fact, and if there is an objective, reasonable fear that you're not going to get a fair trial, you first do a motion to recuse here in Florida with the actual judge who you're seeking to ask to leave, and get a new judge on the case. If that judge denies the motion to recuse, then if it's a properly verified motion, it can be appealed, but it's not really called an appeal. It can be taken to the appellate court by what's called a writ of prohibition. And so that in that particular case, what happened was there was a case where the actual judge had said that she was involved with one of the attorneys on another case, and so had disclosed this. And then when the litigant asked for her to be recused, she said no, and we took that up to the appellate court, and they said, well, that's a good reason, and she should have recused herself, and they basically said she's no longer on the case.
You know, we're going to have to take a quick break as well, but we're going to be coming right back, and we're also going to be talking about an arena that the Charles practices with has to do about personal injury law, as well as Ronald Bell does, and I know that you do that type of appeal work too. We're talking with Robin Bresky from the law offices of Robin Bresky, a boutique firm. You have several attorneys. I lost count. How many do you have?
There's six attorneys.
Six attorneys, yes. As well. And, of course, I'm here with Charles Moorhead, who is the president-elect of the bar and one of the top 1% of the attorneys practicing in the United States, as well as Gary Singer, syndicated columnist for the Sun Sentinel and 400 other media outlets. And we're going to be coming right back to talk about the appeal process, our rights, and God bless America.